You are an old man who thinks in terms of nations and peoples. There are no nations. There are no peoples. There are no Russians. There are no Arabs. There are no third worlds. There is no West. There is only one holistic system of systems.
Welcome back to another episode of System of Systems, the audio misinformation arm, the Safety Propaganda Counterintelligence Network. This is Adam. I'm here with a reoccurring guest host, Bradford Kessler.
Hello.
And we have a very special guest today. He's been called the most famous Nordic artist since Edvard Munch. And I'm a longtime fan of his work, and we're very honored to have him here. Bjarni Melgaard, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Do you see me in the picture?
Yeah. You're right there.
It's okay. I don't need to change positions or anything.
You're perfect. We got you.
Okay. Awesome.
So,
how are you?
I feel great. I actually had a preposterously long sleep last night, which never happens to me. So I feel pretty fucking good.
Yeah.
What about you?
We just returned home from Bangkok.
How was Thailand?
Fantastic. I produced all my sculptures there, and we also made the movie, and we made the photo series. That is like super pornographic. I lost my show at Ramekin Crucible by showing him two photos.
really?
Yeah, because now it's racist to say that you like to suck black cock.
Of course.
Like that's suppressive. So I'm doing this show in the private museum in New York now, where I'm showing my new movie, Barney Does It All, and I show new sculptures and paintings.
I'm excited to see it. You're coming to New York for that, right?
Yeah, sure. I'm staying from the 5th to the 7th.
All right, so we'll definitely come check out that show for sure.
Yeah, sure. Come to the opening.
How long did it take you to put together the photos and did you incorporate like Thai prostitutes and such like that?
It was more, it was friends of us, but also escorts and prostitutes.
Excellent.
It's also connected. I mean, because my movie, Barney Does It All, it's mainly about me identifying as a whore since I was 15.
Yeah.
And then, I went into art education for many years, and I studied at the postgraduate institutes in the Rijksakademie in Jan van Eyck. And then I just felt like, at one point of education that I don't have it. I don't have the ambition to be an artist. So I'm born in Sydney. So I left for Sydney and I just became a beach bum. I've been like a drug addict for 35 years. So I had quite a heavy habit. And then I started working as a hooker and an escort. And I was doing like the streets. But one of my friends got killed. Like he was half Australian, half Aboriginal. So I joined this agency called Alexander, which was like, the kind of main escort agency of Sydney. And, at that point, now I'm like 56, like a worn out old faggot, but I was like reasonably handsome when I was younger.
Yeah.
But I wasn't steroids then. So yeah. I was kind of like the loser of the whole agency. No, because I also had this kind of weird intellectual idea of that I was kind of like Paul America in My Hustler by Andy Warhol.
Yeah, for sure.
So I contemplated like that Paul America look where I had my hair sleeked back, jeans jacket without anything under, and also ultra tight jeans, which was like super unfashionable at the time.
Yeah.
Did you have cowboy boots?
Whenever I went to a bar and just have a beer, people were mainly asking, what's your price?
What
But
steroids were you using?
I was using everything.
Yeah.
Was using, Testo. I was also like using, when I lived in Berlin, I was, for instance, using Garnabool.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that one.
That is a horse testosterone that makes muscles for horses grow.
Oh, like Tren? Like Trenbolone?
Yeah.
I've done Tren before. It's fucking nuts.
Yes.
I
I
did it
was
for a
I was
month and I
I was
looked like a fucking god.
I was I was you know I used to, when I lived in New York, I used to be on steroids for about 12 years.
Wow, that's longer than most like professional bodybuilders use them
I
heavy
was,
duty.
you know, listen, I was asked to become Mr. Miami.
So you were doing actual bodybuilding.
Was actually doing the real bodybuilding.
That's
So when
fucking
I went
awesome.
to a club in New York, I took my shirt off. I had like 50 guys hanging after me. But my problem was always like I was always so out of it. So, a lot of the times it didn't really work that well.
You weren't
But
saving any money, I take it. You weren't saving the money, I take it. You're
no, but
spending
in
on
Sydney, like I started to think, okay, I'm the escort who makes no money here.
Yeah.
Then I realized that there's a huge client base at the agency who have no hookers. And that's the ones who wanted to do like scat, S&M, breath control, like for instance, having love affairs with the hookers. So I started to take them as clients. And suddenly, I was booming. And I became, known as Barney Does It All.
So there we go. There's the fucking name of the movie.
That's the
Barney
name
does
of the
it all.
movie.
Oh man, that
So
was a great
this is
fucking
amazing.
long-winded answer.
So you
That's a press
know,
release.
so you know that that was, so the movie is kind of, about both this identification as a whore, working in period as a hooker escort, but also moving into the art world as a whore. Because I think that, the art world makes artists into whores.
I
We're
couldn't,
selling ourselves, we're putting us out there. We have to put on Instagram, we have to go to galleries, we have to meet collectors. And, I think that if an artist is honest, he will say that I hate collectors. Because what they do is that they buy radicality for 5 minutes.
yeah.
And, I have also very good collector friends. So it's a duality in it. But the movie also is about kind of me being in New York, but also like, my demise as a crystal meth addict, where in the end, I went bankrupt. I went from having a 2,000 square feet studio with 20 assistants to having nothing.
Yeah.
And I had to go back to Norway and stay at 3 square feet room at my mom. And I went into rehab. And I also was then involved here in Oslo in a kind of heavy criminal activities, which I actually preferred to, being an artist in New York.
Yeah. It felt less soul sucking, you mean?
Yes, it actually felt more honest.
Yeah. Something more raw.
Yeah. So that's what the movie is about. And then there is paintings and there's my new sculptures that I produce in Thailand. And I made five sponsor deals with the biggest Botox and Restylane and anti-aging products in the world, in America. And I can send you photos later, but the sculptures have cups. So they will be filled with Botox, Restylane, the whole place where the sculptures are kind of like integrated with all these products of Botox, Restylane, you know, needles and all of those things.
Genius.
And there's also a huge vitrine which shows, you know, diaries, work stuff, and, you know, everything like that. And then there's the movie that they have built the cinema for.
Amazing. You know what how I find? Yeah, sorry, go ahead, Bradford.
Oh, sorry, I just wanted to ask how long the movie is.
It's 25 minutes.
Cool.
Perfect. You know what I find amazing, Bjorn, is that fucking all the shit that you endured in the art world. And I used to see you around everywhere. You know, you were really like a big, big deal. And you got fucked over, but your lust for working is like as profound and powerful as it seems to have ever been.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, like it's also now, you know, because I came to Norway and, you know, my career was basically over. You know, I had still some very loyal big time galleries like Ropatch.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And so I still was connected by, you know, I was still doing drugs and I just couldn't manage to stop.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't fun anymore. It was just that I couldn't get out of bed without it.
Yeah. Heroin was my thing, and it's been about 11 years since I used now, but by the end of, what was it? It was basically 10 years of on and off opioid addiction. And
yeah.
At the end of it, it was like I was in grad school and I have no idea how I managed to get through it, but be sitting around waiting for my dealer and then get to class. But there were so many times that I would just be like in class sick as a fucking dog.
Yes.
Having to like pretend that I felt okay and I was done with it. I mean, yeah. I'll still smoke weed now, and I'll still, I use psychedelics occasionally.
Yeah.
And I have trouble sleeping, so I'll take an Ambien or whatever if I have to. Yeah. But I just like avoid any heavy stimulants, cocaine, crack.
Yeah, me too. Heroin. Yeah. I mean, me too, because, but what I did that helped me become sober was that I went to ketamine therapy.
Oh, wow. I've been hearing about this.
Because, you know, like my husband, he endured 6 years of my heavy drug abuse. And, you know, we started to look for, you know, and it didn't work in the beginning, but suddenly I felt this feeling of how it felt to feel good. Mm. And it was so long time ago that I could remember that how it felt to feel actually comfortable in your own body and not hating yourself and just wishing you were somebody else. And, you know, just feeling like everything you do is shit. And I made all these shit shows to pay my taxes or, you know, whatever. And somehow, after a while, you know, that worked. And now I've been sober for quite a while. And you know, my career kind of took off again. I started to get a lot of offers from Asia, from Berlin, from New York, from Chicago. I did a lot of also, I also like to work with really young independent spaces with young people. And so I move in between like museums, small independent spaces, and more professional galleries.
Yeah, that's surprising. Well, maybe not that surprising, but Ramekin Crucible's Cowardice, because I feel like they've kind of branded themselves as like a
semi-edgy
gallery. Yeah, he sounds like a cunt for sure.
You know, he canceled my show because I sent him two photos for my photo series in Bangkok where I'm sucking on a black cock.
And he said, and what, you're objectifying black people.
A lot of people are pretend edgy too.
He meant that I was planting pornography on his WhatsApp to make something happen. I mean, he's so paranoid that.
Wow.
But it's also the problem of, you know, these New York hipsters, you know, they think they're so cool, and everything has to be so cool, and for me, I could never identify with that because I was never cool. I never felt cool and I never did really cool things. And as a teenager, I was like, I was fat, I was nearsighted, and I had no friends. Mm. And the only thing that interested me was No Wave by Lydia Lunch and yeah. DNA and Tina Jesus and the Jerks.
Yeah. And Mars.
And Mars, of
Mars
course.
Is fucking amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, honestly, the fact that I got kicked out of the art world, basically out of all publishing.
Did you used to be an artist?
Yeah, I still make some work, but primarily a writer, you know? And I was like sort of just contributing essays and things like that to various magazines. And then I got publicly fired from this publication called The Quietest, where I had a regular column.
Yeah.
And, they fired me because I defended a friend of mine who they dislike very much for whatever fucking reason. And they accused me of repressed Nazism. It's the most insane fucking email I've ever gotten in my life. But anyways, that sort of ricocheted. And then no one would work with me anymore. Yeah. And then, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me because then COVID fucking happened and it forced me to just build my own thing, which ended up working out.
But that's what happened when I did this show in Germany that was closed by the German state called Black Low.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember hearing about this. The Germans are fucking nutbags.
That, you know, once, I mean, I am not a Nazi and I'm not interested in them. And but you know, there, if you work with all these black metal bands,
yeah, of course.
I mean, they literally say black metal is for white people,
right? Yeah, it's about Viking glory and Europeanism and all,
and also like very much Nordic mythology and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, but I feel like, If you work with art and you work with thematics that can be difficult, I think it's a different format to present it in an art context than if you do it like in a newspaper.
100%, yeah.
And but I mean, when my show was closed, it's the only show in post Europe that was closed by the German state. Not even Hitler actually closed the show. So I came to the opening.
That's a good accolade.
And then at the opening, there were like 60 policemen and all my artworks were covered with, you know, Achtung, Warnung, you know? So you know, and so once you get that stamp on you that you're a neo-Nazi, I mean, I also did a show in Madrid where I used pages from Norwegian neo-Nazi magazine. I painted over them, and I was in the selection for Documenta with Ukri and Vesor, and when they saw that, they canceled my Documenta participation immediately. So you know, it's a theme that is almost impossible to have any discourse about.
I made a narrative film like 2015 it was a short porno I made for the New York Porn Film Festival. And I depicted, this is a fictional world I depicted. It's not even autobiographical, it's a narrative story. And the character in it, who's a serial killer, has a weapon with the swastika on it. And like that, people didn't even, you know, people that didn't even see it, those are the ones that like really like came at me hard. But like I lost a museum show, I've definitely like things snowballed, and like there was a dead era from that. And like I realized like all these people, it's like you're saying, all these people in the New York art world that pretend to be edgy, it's all a facade. Those were the ones that really, like, when they talked to me about it, I could hear in their voices like they really like were bothered by the imagery, the content. They're actually like extremely
crude. It just happened now again with, you know, Zach, who does edition in Melbourne.
Yeah.
He had a show at Jenny's. Jewish. And he made a painting of, you know, collectors as Nazis. And Jenny took and, you know, censored it and refused him to show it. So he covered it with plastic and wrote censored by Jenny's.
Whoa! And,
you know? And
that's nuts. And
that's supposed to be like the cutting edge space show.
Yeah, she represents Matt too. She represents Zach. Oh my God, that is bad.
People
are fucking frauds. I swear to God, it drives me insane. Unless you make something with like, if you don't make your art with like an explicitly condemning tone in the fucking content, which erases anything that could possibly be interesting about it, because it's in the engagement with the audience in this way that gives something its power. The what if factor is what art is. It's the ponderousnessness. And they want you to erase that just so they can present it in a way that'll offend the least amount of fucking people. It's pretty fucking grotesque.
Yes. And now I also think what is dangerous now is that we are now suddenly not allowed to have a fantasy life anymore. And I think that for me, you know, if you for instance have rape fantasies, it's, you know, it doesn't mean that the day after you want to walk down the street and a wacko knocks you down and rape you. It's just two different things. But I think if we are not allowing ourselves to have a fantasy life that is free, I mean, what in the end do we have?
Yeah.
They refuse to factor in the concept of catharsis, that we need a society, a place to like just let it all go. Let all the dark shit go. Fucking, we're crystals.
It's made us all liars too, hasn't it? Because at least every man has hated someone and fantasized about what it would be like to kill that person.
Yes.
And if you know you haven't, you're a liar. So it's like it's actively turning, it's actively making us all into fucking liars against our own will, you know?
When I did the Venice Biennale in 2011, I collaborated with Leo Bersani, who is a culture theorist, who wrote this essay that is kind of famous called The Rectum is a Grave. And he also published a book where he was saying that, you know, we are all serial killers. It's just, you know, it's all just accidental who actually becomes this. This is not something, there is not some specific personality who is a serial killer, but there are many factors who does it. And I think that, you know, if we are not willing to at least discuss these things and talk about them, you know, we are slowly going into, you know, a place where we have an intellectual discourse on the level of a 5-year-old.
Yeah. It's made everybody very stupid, for sure.
Yarni, do you think this is like sort of a poisonous issue with just specifically the art world? Because think about like the film world, how many directors specifically make slasher films, you know, over and over? How many novelists are able to...
No, fiction's pretty fucking bad right now. I mean, I can't get shit published unless it's like the fucking... even with the most underground publishing houses, I get fucking a bajillion questions from my publishers and editors about every single sentence.
It might be because you're in bed with the art world.
Yeah.
It might be because you're on the podcast with me and Bjorn. Like, you know, they assume everything making is autobiographical. Whereas like John Carpenter, all these directors
made
like killer films for decades, you know, like nobody judged them for it.
Yeah. No.
You know.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. Think about Jonathan Glazer, for instance, just made The Zone of Interest. And he is getting a little heat for the fact that he's showing Nazism at its most like root ideological form in a very formal way. It is, you know, he honestly is like in a lot of ways asking us to take the position of someone ideologically brainwashed or consider what that must be like.
Yeah.
And there were certainly like whispers of like, this is inappropriate, blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
But ultimately it's like the film is a way where you can like, it just forces enough people to really think about it. Whereas like other more neutral art forms, like visual art, is very opaque and oblique and personal.
Yes.
So it's like that amount of discussion never kind of happens around the work. It's like the dealers, the curators, they decide what everyone else thinks. It's a much more like top-down system.
But it also is now, you know, it's almost like the curators are creating the art.
Yeah.
I also talk a lot about that in my film. Like, for instance, like, you know, the bitterness of, you know, failed artists who becomes curators and gallerists and actually hate art and hate artists.
Yeah. It's interesting what you said before. It's interesting what you said before too. There's this S about we're all serial killers.
Yeah.
Fred Boding wrote this essay about Peter Curtin, and he makes the argument at the end that like if Peter Curtin had gotten into experimental writing or something like that, then maybe he could have like decompressed his sadism into a positive channel.
Yeah.
But God, I have so many questions I want to ask you, but I wanted to turn real quick to this thing right here.
Hey!
the new issue.
The Japanese nightmare.
Yeah. So for the audience, there's a new issue of Richardson Magazine, Andrew Richardson's pornographic art magazine that is for sure one of the best still existent magazines. And Ray Lil Black, a porn star that I'm sure many people are familiar with, is on the cover, photographed beautifully by David Sims, and interviewed by none other than Bjarne here. So how was that entire experience? It sounds like the interview got rather hostile.
Well, to try to get an interview with Ray Lil Black is almost impossible. I knew, and Andrew's a very good friend of mine.
Yeah.
I love Andrew. I love Richardson. I love how he talks about sex. I love that no matter what he do, you know, he has always respect for people. He treats people. He's into all this kind of weird stuff. But at the same time, he's a real good person.
Yeah.
And I always, he was, you know, even at my lowest in New York, he was always cool to me. So he phoned me and asked, you want to interview Ray Lil Black for Richardson? And I was like, Ray Lil Black, who? Because I'm gay and I don't watch straight porn.
Yeah.
And I don't even watch porn because I'm married to a husband who is, amazing. So yeah, I said, yeah, I check her out. And I checked her out and I saw her YouTube videos. And then we decided to do an interview. And I did, you know, some research. And I found it kind of amazing that a porn star is making like 10,000 food blogs and, you know, go to 500 billion food conferences and, you know, eats all the time and never seem to gain a pound.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and then I watched some of her porn and, you know, like, I also saw her first, you know, the one that went virtual for the first time. And my question was a lot, and that was in the interview, because the interview was heavily edited because half of the questions, she didn't want the interview in the magazine.
Interesting.
You know, but Andrew insisted on it, but a lot of it was because I think that a lot of her appeal is that in her film, she looks like she's 12.
Yeah, she gets fucking mad when you ask that question. She goes, that question is very disgusting, and I wish you didn't ask
it. You know, she was so upset.
Yeah.
But I mean, come on. It's true.
Yeah. I mean, she does look very young. She's got huge tits, but her face looks very sort of, it's that sort of Japanese cutesy kind of thing.
Yes. So, you know, we tried to make, me and Andrew tried to coordinate the Zoom conversation with her about 35 times. And that was impossible because she's always at a food conference. And I thought, aren't you doing porn? You know, like, what is this? I mean, either she's in Brazil eating a fucking sausage, or she's in, like, Japan eating sushi, or she makes, you know, a video where she eats a tarantula. And, you know, and then I thought, like, you know, I also asked people in the bar about it, like, I realized that she was really big as a porn star.
Yeah. She's top 20 on Pornhub.
That she's really like somebody who straight guys really get turned on by.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was interesting for me to dwell into that, and I saw her YouTube channel, which I think is really boring, but it's also always is endless porn blogs. But then she suddenly published this YouTube video where she has a you know, a meltdown, where she's like, you know, she's basically, you know, falling apart in front of the camera, crying how lonely she is. She hasn't had a boyfriend for 6 years.
Yeah.
So hard to, you know, after her surgery, people said she was uglier than she was before. But what she did with this YouTube video was that she put music to it and she translated it into three languages.
So and it's attention-getting.
And I thought it was a little bit like, you want to make this authentic kind of social meltdown while, you know, you translate it into three languages. And she got very insulted by that.
Yeah.
And then I also, you know, like while I was doing it, I was doing kind of Ray Little Black art. And, you know, we sent her photos and she hated it.
Yeah. They're in the magazine.
Yeah.
They're fantastic.
Yeah. She thought, I also painted a painting of, because, you know, she's really obsessed with Norwegian black metal.
Yeah, I see her wearing like the Mayhem and
yeah, but she also t-shirts. She also went to Bergen to walk the same street as Bulsum. You know? And so she's really, and I thought that was kind of interesting for a young Japanese girl who does porn to, you know, have that interest, because I was also so connected to the black metal scene in my own work. So you know, I thought that was interesting, but I think that she, I don't think she likes sex.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you mentioned that, right? So she's the, this is a full disclosure, she's the only girl I've ever subscribed to on OnlyFans. And I disconnected because she's going to find out now. I didn't want my wife to find out. So yeah. I disconnected, but I was watching her content. And she did this one video where she had like a wedding ceremony, but she was like marrying herself in this like symbolic gesture of like, I'm okay being alone. And it was like very obviously a mentally ill fucking thing. And it just, you know, I think a lot of these girls, because 18-year-old girls are kind of dumb, right?
Yeah.
So they make this decision thinking, oh, it'll be fine. I'm into sex. But there's this show, the Nelk Boys. Typically, they just interview fighters. These guys are awful, but they interview UFC fighters. I'm a UFC fan, so their videos come up. One of the smeegee little hosts does this sideshow where he just interviews porn stars. And the show is always set up to sort of frame the girl as self-aware, intelligent, knows what she's doing, and yet they always kind of end up revealing themselves as very dumb and like totally fucking damaged by with rare exceptions, you know, of course, but like in general, the show just kind of reinforces a negative stereotype of these girls. Yes. And you know, because you're men and women alike, but women especially, their brain and mind changes so much from 18 to 24. You have to wonder, like, if Ray Little Black just feels a lot of shame about everything.
But I mean, from Andrew, I heard that she started porn because she had a lot of debt.
Mm.
And she's also very well educated. So she's not dumb.
Mm.
She's in it for the money.
Yeah.
But if you're really in it for the money, porn isn't the place, because it doesn't pay that well.
No, it's only like 1%.
You know, like when I used to live in New York, I had porn stars as boyfriends, and you know, they got two, you know, they were like at Falcon with the old calendars and everything, and they got paid $2,000 a movie, so they had to escort, you know, so the films are basically not porn films, but more, you know, advertisements as them as escorts.
Right, right.
So you know, and I, and you know, so you know, I think that, you know, she's interesting because she's so cold.
Yeah.
You know, that there's a complete lack of any emotional engagement in what she does.
That's fascinating.
You know, and it's like texting with her is like texting with a robot. You know?
Yeah.
And so you know, the interview it became what it became, and I kind of thought it was funny that she hated me so much. You know,
no, it works for the interview. It's absolutely amazing. Like, because you're kind of reading through it and her answers are kind of whatever, but then she gets pissed and it becomes this like great piece of reading, you know, like kind of,
yeah.
It just makes the thing sing so much better. Japan does have a pretty good black metal bands, but you know, like,
but you know that she still lives with her parents, who doesn't know what she does.
Whoa!
Wow!
You know, we had one conversation where, you know, she lives in Tokyo with her mom. So while she's doing, you know, Asakira Pornhub live Instagram, her mom is next door cooking noodles. And yeah. She's also like, you know, I was asking questions about, you know, for instance, how your family feel about you doing porn. And then she said she got blackmailed. And she was very insulted. I asked this, and how could I ask her this? Because I was putting her family in danger. And then, you know, I went on YouTube the other day, and there's 5 YouTube videos of her family walking in the parks in Japan. So you know, she just, in the end, I don't know what to think of that girl. What do you think of the photos?
The photos by David?
Yeah.
I think they're amazing because they kind of my wife Michelle was even looking at the magazine, and she even admitted she's much more beautiful than most porno girls are, and I think that's true. Like, she has sort of a natural, exquisite beauty.
Yes.
And David kind of frames that, even though the photos are hypersexualized, you know, and she looks a bit more natural than usual porn girls have, like, dolled up fucking faces, like,
yes,
you know, she has this sort of mystery that
she also have a very like kind of low-key down style,
yeah, you know, it seems a little less self-conscious.
She will dress like in a black dress or like a hoodie, you know. And be, I mean, she doesn't, I mean, she's not Ginger Lynn, to put it like that.
Right, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But yeah, I thought the interview was great, and just, you know, an amazing collaboration all around. You know, I was also curious, that installation you did, I forget what year it was, but the one when you gave away, like, your whole wardrobe?
Yeah.
Was that I tried to get into that, but it was like, it was fucking packed. Like, everyone showed up to that one.
Yeah.
Did you, when you ended up going to rehab, end up regretting giving away all your clothes?
No.
No.
I didn't
remember. Yeah, I have a couple things from that.
I was just happy to get rid of it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I also just there is. I also once I did a museum show in Oslo where I gave away my whole storage of art for free.
Wow! I wish I was at that show.
And you know, so people. But what was funny was I put it, all the artworks, in the courtyard of the museum, and I was thinking, like, you know, this is gonna, like, you know, slowly disappear to the autumn poetically. People take a piece at a time. And what happened was 7 o'clock in the morning, people came with, like, you know, cranes and, trucks and stood in line. So after 10 minutes, the whole courtyard was, you know, empty.
But
I like the aspect that some art can be for free.
Yeah. It's sort of like a spiritual reset.
You know?
Yeah.
But also, I also think that show at Red Bull, it was also kind of, you know, I was at my lowest point in a way. I was bankrupt. I was, you know, completely addicted to meth. And I was, you know, I had to just get out. Yeah. And I just thought, you know, I'm not going to move to Norway with 10,000, you know, Yamamoto clothes or whatever. So let's just get rid of the fucking thing.
Kind of like a spiritual reset in a lot of ways, I'm sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Hey, Bjarni, I have like this plushie doll. I wish I would have got it out. I have this plushie doll with the holes in it.
Yes, that's from a show I did with Babak Radboy. You know, he worked with Telfar.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
And we did whole museum show in Austria where we made those dolls, and we made those tracksuits with holes in them. I don't know if you ever saw them.
They were like,
That's when I worked with fashion,
I have this. It's like a paper mache voodoo doll. This guy with a little dick and white hair.
Yes,
somebody from Red Bull gave it to me, and it's fucking falling apart. But I still have it. It might last like 6 more months.
Yeah.
Do you still keep up with fashion, and do you, what do you think about where the industry has gone since that whole
thing? I have, next year I'm doing my biggest fashion collaboration ever, but I'm not allowed to say who it is.
Oof, momentum built.
Momentum built. But fall 24 is launching in Asia, America, Europe, with a very big label. And I also work with a Norwegian label now. I work with producing my own perfume. I also work with an underground label. That's my favorite, called Wendy and Jim in Austria.
I'll check that out.
So you know, I'm definitely interested in fashion.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in, you know, the whole, you know, the idea of creating a narrative about yourself. And I still have contact but next year will be a lot of fashion. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. You know what I like about the fashion industry? Is when it does do gestures to sort of politically, when it does gesture towards politically correct thinking, as it was sort of forced to do from like 2017 to 2020, we all know fashion is like, it's commerce, like, and it's like unadulterated form. So you can sort of like discard all the ideological commandeering of it and just enjoy the pure fantasy space. It's sort of like the last creative industry that's almost like still allows you to engage in unadulterated apolitical fantasy.
Yes, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, thank you. I feel that, you know, the people I work with in the fashion industry is, you know, way more open than people in the art world.
Yeah.
And you know, like, I was also like, you know, when I made my first collection with Babak, you know, I also did a collection with a German fashion label, Bless.
I know that one.
And you know, the first client was Rihanna.
Nice.
And the second client was Kim Kardashian.
That's number one and two.
So you know, when Rihanna was 30 years old, she wore my I Hate Rihanna t-shirt on Instagram.
Amazing. You know? Amazing. Yeah, actually, Bradford, remember you and I were talking about starting a fashion label for bodybuilders because none of the clothes fit me right because I'm too fucking wide?
Yeah, we kind of let that go. We got to come back to that.
We got to get back on that. And for bodybuilding women, too. They have nothing to wear.
Yeah.
Spandex all day.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get to this. Let's get to your most recent discord in life, which was your former backers.
Yes.
I don't Stein Lay and Vain Roar Grande, something like that.
Yes.
They fucked you over for a lot of money, correct?
300 million krona.
Jesus. So how did that all play out? They basically took advantage of you when you were strung out is the story that I heard.
The thing was that while I was on meth, I signed a lot of contracts. And in the end, I signed away my signature. And I signed away also the rights for my sculptures and graphics. So they have been producing works. And at one point in Norway, I had 50 shows at the same time in different frame shops and shitty galleries all over Norway.
Oh my God.
And, you know, I tried, you know, like, since I signed these contracts and I was also then not sober. I couldn't really know how to stop them before I met my new lawyer who also is kind of a part of my new management, because now I'm so paranoid doing something. So I don't do anything. I don't sign a paper without 10 lawyers reading it first.
Yeah. I mean, you're a big artist.
But the whole case was so much in the media here. And I was portrayed as, you know, the number one drug-wrecked whore of Scandinavian art. It was just like, you know, I mean, what they were writing was just, you know, but that was our only chance to, you know, start the court case. And while we were finding it out, we found out that my management in New York had been scamming me for 10 years.
I believe it.
And you know, so for instance, when we were asking for account transfers from my company, my management have erased all accounts for the last 12 years.
Fuck that.
So, but what they have also done is they have imported all this art without, and they have said to the authorities, it belongs to me. But I have never, you know, they gave me money so I could have my studio and they got art back. But they told authorities that, you know, this all belongs to Bjarne. So we don't need to pay any taxes or anything. But, you know, I had no clue. So what is happening now is that they are facing up to 5 years in jail.
Yeah. And honestly, the articles that I read, they sound guilty as fuck. Like, their quotes are like, oh, we wish this was handled in private, but they're not like denying a single fucking thing. So,
no.
It looks pretty bad for them. And it, let's face it, fucking financial backers are not exactly the public's preferred human beings, you know? We know that these types are kind of... I mean, Bradford, you've had fucking issues.
My problem was that as an artist, I was always, you know, almost willing to do anything to get my artwork done.
Yeah.
And I also come... I come from a very... I'm from a working class background. So for me... I always had to fund my own things. I lived from art since I was 20.
Yep.
But I never had rich parents or anything. So, you know, I was, you know, always depending on, you know, trying to get my works done. And that cost money. And you know, I'm not saying, I was a drug addict a long time before I met them. I had lived in Berlin and I had overdosed 20 times. And I lived in Brussels and I lived in Barcelona and I lived in Sydney and I lived in Paris and I lived in Antwerp and God knows where. But, you know, I had 5 lawyers working on it and they said they'd never seen anything similar. Because there is, in all those years, in every correspondence, there is never a question about how am I? How are you doing? You know, we had meetings where I'm so drugged out that I can basically not sit in a chair.
Yes.
So, you know, they completely fucked up my market in Norway. And then everybody said that, you know, Bjarne is over, you know, he's finished. And I had a lot of taxes to pay and the newspapers were following me everywhere. So I did, you know, a graphic show, an edition show of sculptures. And everybody says like, well, you know, Bjarne, you know, you're not going to get your taxes paid because nobody's going to buy anything. But I sold 130 sculptures in 8 hours.
Fuck and, yeah.
And I sold for $1.2 million.
Fuck yes. Congratulations.
But what happened was, first I had to pay production and then taxes. So from those 12 million kroner, me and my husband were left with 68,000 kroner together.
but the taxes are covered, you know, right?
So I got my taxes paid.
Got the man off your back.
But then, you know, I started getting, you know, serious offers for shows from people. And now I have shows, you know, I have shows in Mexico, in Asia, US, Europe, England, and you know, I live together with my husband in a very nice flat here in Oslo. I have a studio that's just 2 minutes away, so every night we walk because I paint at night. And we paint and he stays in my studio and I'm inspired. And this, the show in New York and the show I did in Oslo is the first 2 shows I did sober in 35 years.
That's a huge milestone.
Congratulations. Yeah.
And you know, I never felt that I was always wondering, could I be creative without drugs?
Yeah.
But I just now I feel like I am like overflowing with ideas.
Yeah, probably more creative.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean,
but also weird thing is that I feel much more crazy now than when I was on drugs.
Well, you know what it is? It's like, actually, Nick Cave of The Birthday Party, etc. He does this fan page. People write him letters and he answers them. And someone asked him about, they're strung out on heroin and they asked him about getting help, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, the floodgates of the world are entirely open now. I notice the rustle of the leaves. I notice the crispness of the air, the stench. Yes. Everything starts to come alive. I mean, I have this same question. I was like so sort of in my head about this concept of like junkies and artists, but I didn't get fucking anything done when I was strung out. And now I've written, I mean, my first book that I published was about this question about like creative instinct and addiction. I think for all the people that died, all the artists that died before they got clean, we don't even really know what their best stuff was. You know,
yes.
That's one of the tragedies of it, because they were diluted.